For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Welcome to Season 8 of The Clink. My name is Jay, and I work closely with Brent on the show. To start this season, we wanted to sit down and talk about a really sensitive subject that has sort of shaped Brent and who he is. Now, firstly, I have to apologise. We recorded this in our studio, and on the day we had some technical malfunctions, which meant the audio you'll hear is from a video camera that was in the room at the time, not the quality of the mic I'm using right now. But the story was so important that we wanted to make sure we didn't go and redo it. And to be honest, the stuff we captured is inspiring and also heartbreaking. We wanted it to be raw and real. So you'll hear Brent in his most emotional state that I've ever heard him. This is Season 8 of The Clink and Brent's story. And a trigger warning, this episode contains graphic content and child abuse.
And we don't normally do this where I'm part of the podcast.
No.
But this time I am.
Well, to be absolutely honest, there's no one else I'd rather do it with, purely for the fact of how sensitive it is and the conversation that we will have. So.
We've talked, you know, back in, I think it's season two, where we actually got your story, your life, before Redemption.
You did. It was something that I was reluctant to do, as you remember.
Yeah. Reluctance, it's a stronger word, is you went, no fucking way, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, I was just adamant that I'd sort of, my story was out there prior to that, and I just didn't feel that I needed to, you know, put my story, because The Clink is purely based around other inspiring people. Did I see my story as inspiring? Not as much. Since then, obviously, there's a lot of connection that I've had with people and through sharing my story that has made me rethink that and believe that how important it is for me to put myself out there to be a voice for many others that aren't strong enough to be able to sit down and have these conversations, because they are. They're traumatic experiences. They're things that, you know, do trigger. And firstly, I think we should acknowledge that anything that we talk about could trigger anybody out there, that please take care of you and reach out and ask for help, because it is very sensitive. And I believe that I am not the only person, and there are others out there who would have endured a lot more than what I did.
I know you. I know you well enough to know that you're really comfortable in your own skin most of the time. But right now, you're uncomfortable.
Yep.
And I don't know this story. I know part of it, like a very small part of it, right? So, out of respect to you, if there's any point in this conversation where you need a break, then just say it, and we'll stop. We'll come back. I think it's important to first start with you getting into or leaving home and leaving the family system, ecosystem, and actually then, you know, you lived on street for a while. Talk me through that.
Going back, and one thing I want to make clear, today's, episode or chat, I don't want to call it an episode because it's not an episode. This is something that's within me that I... that I feel that I need to do. So it's based around living as a survivor of sexual abuse. The trauma at 46 years of age that I still go through, the mental health issues that I have from it, the way that I've had to live my life, and yes, I've made wrong choices through my own doing, and, you know, we're not here to talk about those. Everybody knows my story in that respect. I've kept silent in the bigger picture of things and never truly opened up about what actually took place because of the process I've been going through. When I say the process, the legal process of seeking justice, there's been several parties involved in that, perpetrators. It wasn't just as simple as one person that basically raped me and forced me to perform sexual acts as a young boy. The particular one that, you know, today that has so much relevance was more around that age of 13, 14. If we go back, for me, the abuse started being a part of a broken home, no support, as you said. My mother had left when I was very, very young. I was left with my father, whom at that stage was basically an alcoholic, quite a violent person in the home towards my sort of mum and myself.
Yep.
The neighbours took a lot of advantage of that. We were a family in a housing community on the Campbelltown area, which back then was quite a strong Indigenous area where I was, in Eds and Bradbury. There was a perpetrator who lived in our street, and then there was two brothers that lived behind the house that we lived in. I guess for me, not wanting to be in the home and being lost as a young boy, and, you know, I'd get on my push bike and I'd ride to the bush and be in the bush all day building dirt jumps or trying to catch tadpoles. Then when I was at home, I would hide under the house. And under the house, I'd have, you know, army tanks and matchbox cars and what have you, and be in this world of just, that was cool, you know, making dirt tracks, puds and mud ponds and,
you know. You just being a kid. Although, you know, living a tough upbringing and, you know, in the houses and, you know, not in any way wealthy, you were just being just a young kid.
I was dealing with what I didn't know what I was dealing with, because what was happening in the home environment was quite exposed, as, you know, there was a lot of violence, a lot of alcohol, to the point where, you know, standing in front of your mother while your father beats her and then, you know, turns on you. And please don't, my father today and I have resolved our issues.
Yeah.
You know, he also too is a survivor, I found out later in life, and I won't go into too much detail, but he endured some terrible, terrible things during his young years as a young scout. He had a father who was a merchant seaman, mother who was, you know, as we call a bar wench back in the day.
Yep.
He went through some terrible, terrible things, and only as a man now and having that time to sit down with him, it's taken us probably 15 years of work to be able to have him open up. You know, he's carried so much burden. So I get...
Can I go there for a second?
Sure.
How do you raise that with your dad? How did you raise it with your dad? What'd you say?
After my father truly hearing and understanding and accepting that what I've carried for many years and spoke out about in reference to my young childhood being so traumatic and so, you know, wrong in every fucking sense, if I could just... I guess he accepted the fact that he wasn't there to protect me. He wasn't there to listen. And even when he did, and I did tell him what was happening to me, I was backhanded in front of these men. And when I say men, I was a boy. These perpetrators were all 17, 18 years of age.
So you're how old at this age?
This is like from the age of 7 through till I was 10.
This is the next-door neighbours.
This is the next-door neighbours. This was ongoing. My mother, you know, would be upstairs and I was under the house being forced to masturbate and do oral acts to these perpetrators, or I'd be cornered down in the bush because I'd have to go through the bush. And I was young and I'd go to football training at the back of St. Thomas More Primary School in Campbelltown. And I'd be bailed up on the way. They'd just sit there and wait. And what does a kid do? You know, I was petrified. So I was taken, you know, advantage of, and my pants were pulled down. And you know, then obviously I was anally inserted with fingers and forced to do oral acts there as well.
You're 7.
Seven, eight. It went on for years. It went on for years because no one would listen. And any time I brought it up, it was just pushed out the door that I was full of shit. I was attention seeking, you know, because of what was going on at home. In the meantime of that occurring, I was at that particular school, St. Thomas More Primary School, where I was, you know, going to school some mornings for, you know, 6 a.m. because I could get breakfast there and it would be a hot Milo and veggie Milo on toast. But I was also being raped by Amara's brother there.
Okay, let's just stop for a second. Amara's brother is a teacher?
He's a priest. He's a brother. He's a religious leader. He's a pillar of the community. He's a trusted person. Mm-hmm. He's somebody whom, you know, you should be able to go to talk about your sins or seek advice from or confide in and be comforted from.
So you're going to school because you're living in a house that, you know, is unsafe. You're not getting fed as well as
I mean, I was getting fed. I wouldn't say that I wasn't getting fed, but it was better for me to go to school early. And what they used to do is they had like an early mass. So, you know, for kids that obviously their parents and to anybody listening out there that went to St. Thomas More Primary, my heart and thoughts go out to you if you're a survivor. And I know that there's survivors out there since going through the process of seeking justice with Amara's brothers.
And you have had justice with Amara's brothers.
I have. And the process of that was extremely painful. It was proven within beyond doubt. There was an apology from the Maris Brothers of Australia, and I've received a letter of apology.
Financial compensation.
There was a small financial compensation.
Felt better, the money or the apology?
Neither. What felt better was the fact that I was proven to be right.
You weren't lying.
No. And for so many years growing up, you basically just told you're full of shit, you're trouble. And, you know, it just didn't happen. Well, it did happen, and the facts are there, and the proof's been there, and it's been now put through the courts, and it's settled, and it was done. That part.
That would have helped your reconciliation with your dad then, I'm guessing.
Look, we had reconciled well before this process. This is only fresh, you know, this is only the last 2 years. So it's taken me at 46 many, many years of, I don't know, like deep thought to whether or not it's even worth pursuing or why would I want to put myself through it. But I had to because it chewed me up inside. My children were getting older. You know, I carried a lot of anger, I guess, and a lot of hurt and pain because I just wanted that door shut. So that door has been shut, and I'm not going to thank anyone because I don't owe anyone anything for it. I have to still live with everything that happened. It doesn't change anything.
So the door might be shut, but the pain's still there.
Oh, 100%. 100%. The worst part being is there's still a massive continuation of this. And it's not the neighbours, because the neighbours were never trialled. There was never any action taken. It's funny, you know, I spent many years in jail and I used to sit there praying that these three perpetrators would one day, because I knew they were shit people, and I'd pray that they'd walk in the yard. Mm. And I was prepared to take their life at that moment if I had seen them walk into a yard. I absolutely had not a second doubt I would attack them to the absolute death.
I don't think there's anyone listening that wouldn't.
No.
Would hold any grudge against you for doing that.
There was no way. It's just not another thought, because what they took from me, I can never get back. what they...
Did that ever happen? Did you see any of them again?
No, and thankfully not, because I wouldn't be here with you right now. I wouldn't have my four amazing children, my wonderful wife, you know, the little wins and successes that I continue to strive towards. So thank God, and I really do thank God that never occurred, because I would be doing life, and how would that have really made, would that have been the satisfaction at the end of the day that I wanted? Well, I wish them nothing but bad luck. do I want to be sitting in jail? No.
Like the Maris brothers, although that door is closed, by getting rid of those three perpetrators as a young boy, you know, later in life, would have done nothing really, right?
No.
Apart from a bit of retribution.
It would have destroyed my life beyond. Right. And you know what, at the end of the day, they would have still been the perpetrators who had destroyed and won. This is the sad part, is as a survivor, at what stage do you find justice? As a survivor, at what stage do you find peace? As a survivor, when do you move forward from these traumas and these acts that nobody should ever have gone through? And this is not about just me. I'm wanting to do this because I have a platform that reaches now millions, and I have a voice. And I believe that as much and emotionally and painful it is telling the story again, and every time it's the same. So you truly never, ever move forward from it. You just try to better yourself each day you wake up,
mm-hmm.
and know that, you know, I have four children, as I said. I mean, three are still under my roof, and I will protect them in every possible way. Not that they're exposed to the things that I was exposed to, and I believe that, you know, the world is a little bit different today in reference to awareness. I think young people these days are a lot more switched on, although vulnerable still, but we are more conscious of these acts happening within sporting groups, churches, community programs. So we as a family, as much as trying to protect, you know, my young children's world, and my, you know, I want them to know the truth, and they need to know who their dad is and who their dad was. You know, I've lived with PTSD, type 2 bipolar. You know, I've had some highs, some lows, and unfortunately they've seen a lot of that.
Yeah.
Why? Why is dad like this? Why? Well, I owe it to them to explain to them what dad has had to live with.
How much detail will you go into?
Enough to know that I'm a survivor of sexual abuse, mm-hmm. and that growing up at their age wasn't good, and that I was incarcerated from that age of 13 years of age. So, yeah, around Keishan's age, you know, where he's now an academic going into his next year, which is high school, under the, you know, academic excellence program, rugby league excellence program. He's a success there. My daughter's doing amazing. She's in music excellence. My oldest son's a sound engineer. Like, my youngest son's just a freak on the footy field. But, you know, they're all achieving in their own wonderful ways. So, you know, once again, I've quoted this many a times before in lots of interviews, that my wrongs are their rights.
Yeah.
There's no curiosity.
Yeah.
And there's no secrets hidden in that respect. As they grow older, if they're curious and want to know more, then I'm happy to sit down and have that conversation. As it stands now, the details, the in-depth, I don't feel are warranted for their young minds to have to hear and go through. And I don't want them pondering on, you know, what happened to dad, because it is, it's very traumatic. I mean, my daughter, who's 15, we can have a pretty straight up conversation these days, and she knows I'm here now. She sent me some beautiful messages of support whilst I was traveling. It's just gorgeous to know that you can have that relationship, and, you know,
yeah.
I love you, Dad. I'm beside you. You know, yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty powerful. So they're not protected from it all because I don't want them to be sugar-coated and put this, you know, wool around them. And they know. They know enough to know what's going on and where it's at.
Okay, so year eight, halfway through year eight, you leave school, but you're still around that area. Talk to me about what happened.
Look, to be honest with you, I was stealing cars and sleeping in cars because I had nowhere to stay. I was, you know, sleeping in the middle of football ovals because at that stage, this particular one had a cricket pitch and used to be pitch black and it was bush that it backed onto. So for me, it was like no one would be game enough to walk through there because it's pitch black. So I'm safe in a sleeping bag in the middle of winter on that cricket pitch to sleep if I needed to sleep. That's what I did. It became too much to go to school. I just, you know, the streets were life and that's where it was. So the crimes started obviously at a very young age because I was surviving. I had to find money, clothes and what have you. I had nobody to turn to. And even in the foster home environment, yeah, I guess those that have been there would only know, but you never really feel accepted. You never really feel you're a part of that family. And you're not. You know, you're not. They're just doing you a favour. They're just keeping you fed, I gather, and a roof over your head. They're getting paid to do it. And that's not to take the credit away from anybody out there that's, you know, involved in fostering, because I think you're amazing people to be able to do that. So
this is just your perspective.
This is just my experience. Yes. Yeah, so please, for the listener, don't take offence to that. It's in no way meant.
Yeah.
And credit to everybody out there that helps these unfortunate people.
But your experience didn't feel loved.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I was just shit and I was the outsider and I just, I'd be there for, you know, a few weeks and I'd just grab my bag of clothes and go. So the street was my life. That meant whilst committing crimes and living on the street, you got caught, you got charged, you got locked up. You know, it was inevitable. It was just part and parcel of what was going on. My first experiences, I was put into Minda, into an area where there was a lot of older boys and stuff like that, Patterson House in Minda, for those that do know or remember it. And it was quite full on. You're in there with young murderers, you know, heavy.
Minda's a child detention center.
Boys home. And it was pretty full on. You know, from there you went up to Mount Penang. Mount Penang was like, you know, that sort of age group where the later teens, even some young adults that had committed crimes, you know, in that 16, 17, that were giving long sentences, were there till they were about 21, some of them.
So too young for jail, but have done some bad things.
Mm, yeah. And, you know, I'd been to Yasmar and I'd been to Rebe and Cobham and done the rounds, so to speak. But I was still, you know, on the street, I managed to build a little bit of a rep because I didn't care. I actually didn't care. There was nothing that I wasn't going to do. And if I wanted something, I took it. And if I didn't get it the way I wanted, then there was going to be a way that I was going to take it that you wouldn't have liked.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that to be tough. And this is how it was.
Yeah.
I felt being that person would protect me from ever going through what I went through in the years prior. How wrong was I? Because here I am sentenced up to Mount Penang, and at that stage, you know, you're up there with the big boys, as they sort of called it. And it happened again. You're in a dorm environment. Workers would come around. Because I was younger then, I was put in like a, not the maximum security where the older boys were. So they had Walpole, Vern and Carina. Sobron was just not, it was like protection. You just didn't go to Sobron.
These are like different wards or
Dorms. They're like dorms, yeah, okay. Like barred in, like full on. But you're all sleeping in the same environment. So
And different areas are for different levels of crime?
Definitely. And, you know, like there was some pretty hardcore boys up there then, you know, and I wasn't one of the hardcore boys in the system. I was just a kid off the streets, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, these, like, I don't know if you remember, but, oh, look, I don't want to name because the crimes were pretty full on back then, but, you know, there was even a group of young men who have, I believe, come out and done a lot of good today, but, you know, were accused of murdering gay bashings in Sydney back then and, you know, jumping off toilet blocks onto their head. It was horrific, the crime, but that's the sort of people that were there.
Yeah.
You know, they were adolescents and...
hardcore.
Yeah, you had, you know, serious gang members from, you know, different sort of Vietnamese, like 5T and all these sort of heavy gangs were chopping people up with machetes. Like, it was full on. Then you got your armed robbers and, you know, your heroin addicts out there that were really hot, heavy in their crime.
To make this really rudimentary and, like, really crass, you're an entry-level crim.
Yeah, I'm just a new kid on the block sort of thing. Yeah, I had been in the city boys' homes.
Yeah.
And rocked around there with no dramas. But, you know, now I've come into...
Playing
with the big boys. You know, you're looking at a whack, you're going in there and that's all there is. So for me, I was not put straight into the bad, bad boys' dorm. I was put into, you know, I guess the newcomers, which was, I think, Carinya at that stage. All of a sudden, there was Laurie Ma, who is a convicted pedophile who ran... he was the mayor of the Central Coast. He and a group of workers have all been since charged and exposed for the pedophile ring that they created up at Mount Penang Boys Home. And I'm speaking this out because I know for a fact there's many boys who have passed and many who are still alive that also went through this. And some of them have gone on to, you know, become extremely hardened men and criminals and doing some of them doing life, some of them doing 10 years, 20. Like, it's just, it's shocking to where they are today from what they went through. I endured sexual abuse there pretty well within a few weeks. They would come around and do a nightly check.
Who's they?
The workers, if you want to put it, the screws, but they were youth workers.
Yeah.
And
Laurie Ma was one of those?
Laurie Ma ran their place.
Okay, he was the boss.
In the late 80s,
yep.
Yeah, so he was the big boss. His trail of abuse goes back to the 70s. I think there was 40 years or something, 30 or 40 years of sexual pedophilia that he was involved with. It was basically a ring of workers. The acts that they would do were atrocious. You know, they would literally force young boys to be anally penetrated, give oral sex, be fondled them. They would, you know, threaten them severely that they would go and tell all the other inmates, for example. Let me simplify it for those that don't understand the way it works. You don't want to be a dog. You don't want to be an informant. You don't want to be someone like that, right? Or have any sexual charges. Because if you do and it's found out, you'll be dealt with in a very serious way. And that's just a criminal code.
By other
inmates.
Other
100%.
Inmates. Yep.
So picture this. You're cornered by a worker in an environment. For example, there was a piggery. The piggery was a spot away from the actual compound, so you couldn't go anywhere and you'd have to go up there to work because each day, you're all going into different workplaces. Certain youth workers would then be in charge of those areas and a certain group of young boys, young men, whichever way you want to put it. This is not directed at all workers because not all workers were pedophiles. But the particular workers that were just so blatant about it. Like, they'd come into the dorms at night and they'd do a check and you'd sleep with one eye open because you'd feel a hand come up under the doona and start playing with your ass or grabbing your balls and, you know, start to rub your dick and, you know, next minute be like, shh, you know, they'd put a hand on your mouth just to quiet you down. This is what you had to deal with whilst you were trying to sleep. You're in a dorm full of young man, what do you do? Do you scream? Do you yell? What do you do? You know, what do you do? He's going to deny it. You're you know, in a panic, so you look weak. Do you just attack him? Do you just, you know, do you carry a pen, a knife? What do? You stab him? You can't explain the feeling of being violated in that way. During the night, for starters.
Was there ever a time where you heard them come in and they didn't come to you and you went, thank fuck, it's 100%, not my turn?
100%. And we used to, there were pods of Datura, and we used to get the pods of Datura and brew them up.
What's Datura?
Now, Datura is a very dangerous plant that can, it's a poison, but it would send us off.
Mm.
Like, it'd be like a full acid trip.
Okay.
So, you know, there was nights there where we'd brew up Datura and all of us would be drinking it, and the whole place would erupt all night long. They couldn't hurt us. We'd hurt ourselves, or, you know, there'd be, unfortunately, things that would happen.
Mm.
But there was no one going to come in there and sexually abuse any of us boys.
Things that would happen, fights, just anger.
Ah, just tripping out. Just you know, the boys getting loose and you're out of control. You're totally out of your body. You're out of your mind. But it was a way of almost numbing as well as, you know, scaring them to the point where they couldn't come in and harm us.
Mm.
Was it general talk that we were being sexually abused? Not at all. No one was game enough to tell another bloke next to him that someone had just come over and played with his dick or forced him to suck the worker's dick. Or there was none of it. It just didn't happen in that way.
Can I ask? And I think I know the answer, but I think for anyone listening, it might help. Why? Why wouldn't you say to a guy that you're in the lockup with, hey?
Firstly, you're vulnerable, and two, did it really happen?
Yeah, okay.
You know, you were forced to fucking pull him off? Oh, you were forced to put his dick in your mouth? Oh, he put his finger in your ass? Who has that conversation?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, who actually sits there and talks about that? So it's
a sense of shame there, right?
Shame, absolute humiliation. You're disgusted. You feel like filth. There's no way to express how to tell someone. Who do you tell? What do you say?
Yeah.
Then, you know, it progresses. So then you're at work and you're carrying this weight around and this anger and this fear during the daytime because you're too scared to sleep at night. So then you will rebel. Oh, go fuck yourself, you know. Next minute you moved into the next dorms.
Mm.
And that's where you start to get in, you know, and then I was put into Vernon and you had Vernon and Walpole, which was the bigger boys saying, now you're coming in there and you need to poke your chest out, shut your mouth, but be ready at all times because you're going to get tested in there by the other inmates. I'm no big name. Right. At this stage, I'm just another, as I said, bare bum in the shower. You know what I mean? Like, it was the new guy. So naturally, they're going to test you. One, you're going to stand up for yourself. Two, you're going to get robbed for your shoes. Three, they're going to take your toiletries off you. You know, well, what is going to happen? Because this is how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a pecking order.
Does the abuse continue as you move dorms?
My next point being, it did. So this particular screw, and I won't say his name because if I do, I know for a fact that...
He's not been charged.
Oh, yeah, no, he's been charged. This is all proven. Okay, this is the point. This is all proven. This is all fact. Not just my story, but also the other young men that had to endure this as well, and there were many.
So people have been charged.
100%.
Absolutely 100% are guilty of these
crimes. 100%.
And are currently locked up.
No, definitely not locked up. No.
Okay, we'll come to that.
They don't get locked up.
We'll come to
that. They don't get locked up. You know, some do, but no. So it's pretty... public, if you want to, you know, go into the... I'm not going to go into the whole naming and shaming. I mean, Laurie Mars is enough. That's all I need to say. He's just one twisted, sick man. And I believe that I don't know. I think he might have passed by now. He was a couple of years ago, 82 years of age when, you know, he was arrested finally. justice was served upon him. Hopefully he's dead anyway. Who cares? This particular worker, he worked also at the piggery. So his way of manipulating the situation, because that was where I was working, was to force you into a position where he would force you to either masturbate him or masturbate, you know, for him, or actually give him oral sex. And you've already lost that sense of, you got no protection, you got nothing, you know, what are you? You're vulnerable. Then the threats come, the threats of, if you tell anybody or you don't do as I want you to do, you're going to get got by the boys. Now, you got to remember, you've moved into a dorm now where it's serious. It's not in the newcomers area where everyone's still quiet and timid. These blokes have done time. They're all solid. They're all, you know, they've been there a while. It gets pretty full on. Last thing you want to do is have a worker come in and say that, so that bloke over there, I've seen evidence that he's a dog. I've seen evidence that he's had sexual charges before. You know, be careful about him. He talks to the screws, to the workers. This is the mentality of the scum that were the perpetrators that abused the boys. This is the things that they would do.
Essentially, the perpetrators are using the other boys as their henchmen.
100%, you know, and obviously they would know their marks that they couldn't. So picture this. You've got your alpha young men in there who are fucking solid and you know, ready to go at any drop of any hour, and they knew that. So they would do anything, you know, friendly with them. I mean, some of them workers would bring them in drugs, they'd bring them in whatever they wanted, contraband. You know, nothing was a problem, yeah. And they were best mates with them. But little did they know that that worker was molesting fucking boys in all parts, in the showers, in the fucking piggery, at night, in the dorms, you know. They didn't know this.
Mm.
So if that worker came up to that bloke who was an alpha bloke that everyone was, you know, around, and said, see that bloke over there? I've seen paperwork on him. He's no good. Mate, you got fucking 30 blokes in a dorm that are going to jump on your head and you've got nowhere to go. What do you do? You know, you're a kid, you're 13, 14 years of age. You've now sitting with 16, 17-year-old young men that are extremely violent, that are, you know, willing to...
You're essentially trapped.
You're trapped.
Yeah. Unless you do some despicable things too.
Well, the only way you could do the despicable thing was to carry a blade and stab the worker to death, or stab that worker enough for them to stop. That was it in a nutshell.
But then you've got life.
100%. No one wants to be stuck in there. You're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I mean, to make an allegation back then that you were being abused by a worker, well, it just would have fallen on deaf ears, and you would have just been absolutely like treated like shit by the worker. You just... Whichever way you thought you could go, you had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So that continued on for some time whilst I was there. And I know that it happened to many young men prior to that and continued after that. The Crimes Commission, there was a commission into child sexual abuse. And that commission, both young women and young men, were acknowledged by the governments through the inquiries about the young persons enduring terrible, terrible sexual abuse, whether it be through foster care, churches, sporting groups, institutions. It was brought to the table finally, and you're dating back many, 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 many years.
This is through the 70s and 80s.
This had been rife, like I said, you know, like, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but my father, you know, he was born in the 50s as a scout, you know, for 2 years, was sodomised and just completely destroyed as a young man. But you could never talk about it, you know. It was never something that could be brought up. You know, he lived with that 60 years of his life before he's sort of opened up. And that's hard, you know, and then he has to hear and see that his son went through the same thing, you know. Like, I get it. I get why, as a man today and a dad, how sometimes I have, you know, moments where I have breakdowns or I'm angry or, you know, struggle to deal with things mentally. But we are able to talk about it today. These survivors back then, that you couldn't talk about it. Imagine that. Your old man's a merchant seaman and you're telling your old man that, you know, you're getting forced to do sexual activities. You
know, no chance.
Just doesn't happen.
So the Crimes Commission happens. It's uncovered that these sorts of sexual crimes are happening and they're rife throughout institutions in Australia.
Absolutely. Institutional abuse, yeah.
You're, I guess, a young man at that stage when that's happening, because it was a while ago that the Crimes Commission happened. So the Royal Commission released the Criminal Justice Report in August 2017. And from that report, it sort of detailed almost percentages, if you like, of where young boys and men and women and girls were abused.
Yeah.
You've got some detail there on what that looks like. Do you want to just give some of that?
Look, many adult perpetrators of abuse held roles associated with positions of leadership and power and authority. So that's a fact that we've had to accept, that this is truth. This is undoubtedly factual. You know, this has happened. People have been held accountable to a point.
Yeah.
Persons in religious communities or ministries was a huge thing.
Yeah.
Then you had teachers, residential care workers, foster care, down to custodial staff, dorm or house masters.
That was the workers you were talking about.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so here we are with this wonderful big commission that then creates the redress scheme. Is something that I think is just, how can I put it? There's a lot of boxes that just get ticked, but very little that actually gets done. I have spent the best part of 18 months waiting for the redress scheme to acknowledge the abuse that I endured as a survivor, to be compensated, and to be given an apology. Here's the flip side of it. They take no responsibility for the employer who was employed by the government that did these sexual acts. So the government won't apologise.
Because these workers are essentially employed by the government in these places to look after, if you like, and control, you know, people like you and people who are incarcerated for crime, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the government have gone, yeah, that's not our problem.
Absolutely. Their acts aren't accepted by the government as something that they should be held responsible for whilst being employed by a government body, i.e. an institution.
Mm-hmm. So let me pull this back to something that I'm going to make this really simple, but just so people can understand. This is you driving. Imagine you're driving a car for your workplace, and on the side of the car, you have the big sticker of the workplace, and you cut off someone in the traffic. Those people call your workplace and say, one of your cars just cut me off.
Yeah.
You get back to work. And no doubt, you're copping
100%. You're getting dressed down by your boss.
Probably a letter to say, "Don't drive the cars badly." Blah 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 blah. Yep. It was your decision as a person to cut the person off in traffic.
Absolutely.
That you're representing a company.
That's right.
And in real terms, these people are representing the government at the time.
Absolutely.
Because they're employed by that government.
They're also employed as a carer. So, yes, they're there to turn keys, I guess, if you want to put it, but they're there to assist, help, protect the young person in custody as well. They're not just there to you know, bring down the hammer upon you and say, you know, you've committed crimes, now I'm here to punish you. That's not their job.
Yeah.
Their job is to assist in your rehabilitation, obviously to make sure that everything runs smoothly in a way that's safe for everybody in the institution. And they're there not to abuse
kids,
children. Now, the redress scheme states that it does take 12 and a half months to process an application and just over 13 months to prioritise. Now, here's the flip side of it. Go and find a survivor that hasn't turned to drugs, didn't commit a crime after enduring such terrible traumas of sexual abuse, especially ongoing sexual abuse. I mean, for me, it went on for years as a young person, so, you know, I can't even explain how my mental state was back then. I just know that I didn't want to live. That was a huge part. And when I did live, everything I did was just rebellious because I was this scared little boy inside a young person's body, you know, developing into a man that carried this pain that no one wanted to deal with or help. So for me, it was just like, well, I don't give a fuck. I'm just going to, you know, do whatever I want to do because nobody cares.
Yeah. Let me just quickly talk about what the National Redress Scheme is. It's a response to the Royal Commission. It's a response into the Royal Commission into institutional response to child sexual abuse. And you can make an application any time before the 30th of June 2027. Correct. So this is essentially looking back at anything that happened.
Prior to 2018.
Correct. So that's what you've done. You know, there's a process. You've been through that in that process for the last 18 months.
So initially I approached an organisation. I'm not going to say the organisation. I approached an organisation that takes the lead role in instigating the process of the justice seeking.
Yeah.
They take the statement of the survivor of what took place, the abuse you endured.
So this is you sitting down?
You're being interviewed about the sexual abuse that I went through.
Yeah.
So let's make that clear when we're making statements. Yeah, it's not statement as in giving someone up. You're actually telling somebody a story about a perpetrator, a disgusting human that has inflicted traumatic sexual abuse upon you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for anybody out there, understand the difference between doing that, you're not giving someone up as in you're not a dog, you're not someone that needs to feel it. Oh, if I go and say someone... If you've been sexually abused, step up and speak up, because the more that we're heard, the more chance we've got of eliminating it happening again to another young person. Yes, there are better inroads. Yes, there is more education. Yes, we're more vocal about it. Yes, it still happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's not on the scale that it once did. That's a fact, which is a fantastic thing. As a survivor, I can tell you now how I feel through this process of the redress. Like I said earlier, the court process and the settlement with the Maris brothers, I'm not going to give credit anywhere, but it was nowhere near as traumatic as the process of going through the redress scheme against the government.
Hmm.
Here's something for you all. I know a lot of people who are survivors of abuse. Some, many I should say, not some, are not here to tell the story because they couldn't live with it. And unfortunately, we've lost them.
Mm-hmm.
Families have lost the loved ones, brothers, sisters, whatever. They're no longer here to be heard. So they've almost been silenced and had their life taken from them. That's after losing their innocence to these perpetrators. The redress scheme does a thorough investigation, rightfully so. I'm all for that because, you know, obviously there's people out there that want to abuse the system and there's the survivors that should receive the justice and if there is any compensation for it. It's not about the money. So let's get that clear. You know, the assistance of the money's not going to change my life.
Yeah.
You know, it might be 10, it might be 20, it might be 30,000. I don't know. And to be honest with you, after this goes to air, I probably won't get a cent. And the way that they do it, they don't want to give me a cent anyway. Mm. It's been proven that these acts happen.
Yeah.
That's not the question at all. Because I am... let me rephrase it, because I have a criminal record and I have served time in custody. The process is different for anybody who has been handed a 5-year or longer sentence of incarceration.
Yeah.
Why? I'm fucked if I know. Because what difference does it make whether someone's done a month, a day, never been to jail, or done 10 years jail?
Mm.
As long as you're not a rapist or a child pedophile, you know, or doing acts of those sort of types, then what does it matter? For me personally, I and I take this as you will, if you're a sexual predator, you don't deserve fucking anything. Like, you know, people go, oh, that's harsh, that's it. Well, it's not harsh. I'm a survivor of many years of sexual abuse. I can tell you now, there's not a chance in fucking hell you would ever see me think, contemplate, or be near any acts that would involve the acts that I went through. It's just, if anything, I'm on permanent protection mode from those that I love and care for,
yeah,
as many, many survivors are. But the way the redress scheme is done, you are completely raped again. And why do I say that? Because the process that you have to go through is just so traumatic in the way that they do it. For the simple fact, for me, on my personal journey right now, this is exactly what's happened with me. I have rung for the last 6-7 months, probably every fortnight, because it's really gotten long in the tooth. And I ring up and I say, oh, hi, it's Brent Simpson here. Oh, hi, can you give us your details? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Oh, your casework. Yep, we'll put you through it here. And mine's escalated to the next level of whatever it is. Hi, Brent, how are you today? Mate, I'm okay, but I'm hoping that you've got some good news for me. Yeah, we're still waiting on our counterparts from around the country to give us some further information about the decision for us to then decide on whether, you know, you'll be compensated or what will take place. What do you actually mean by that? Well, I can't go into detail because it's under our criterial sort of thing. Oh, criteria. So now it's a criteria I have to go through. Yes, that's correct. Okay. Can you explain that a little bit more to me? Well, I really can't say too much. It's just with our counterparts around the country.
So you're essentially, you've said it feels like you've been raped again. And you've been raped by what feels like bureaucracy.
Absolutely.
And finger pointing. That's not my fault. I can't give you any more information. You just have to wait. What needs to change for the redress system to work? Because redress in its most simple form is redressing what happened to you.
And correcting it. Correct.
Either via an apology or compensation,
yeah,
or acknowledgement, or all three.
Or counselling.
Or counselling.
Counselling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. What you've said is the three indicators that they offer, which is an acknowledgement of apology, counselling, or financial.
Can they offer all three?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or they can determine what they feel is best suited to you. Here's the part that is extremely hard. And while I've now decided to bring this to the attention of the public, you're completely judged on the person that you become after that abuse, what jail or crimes that you've done and committed. Now, once again, let me get this clear. I have no sympathy for those who are sexual predators, and if you've committed those acts and you're seeking compensation, look, nobody deserves to be sexually abused, but one would think that if it's happened to you, why would you put it upon another? And I don't want to go down that road, because that's not why I'm here to have this conversation. This is an enlightening conversation to share with people how hard it is to seek justice as a survivor through channels that are supposed to support and help you to receive that. Now, for me, because I have served many, many years in jail, and my last sentence was over 6 years, I fall into a different category for them then now to decide whether or not I'm worthy of receiving any compensation for being forced to suck a man's dick in youth detention and have my ass and balls played with at his call and be threatened and traumatised for my life and spend, you know, 30 or 46, so let's go back, 32 years of hell in my head, you know, that's okay. And this group of people under this redress can now just decide whether or not it's worthy that you receive something to better your situation or life. So now the phone calls have continued, as I said, for 6-7 months up until a week and a half ago. And I've been able to, I guess, let's just say without putting this person in a vulnerable position, break the ice a little bit and get a little bit more feedback, because obviously it's a very fine line with a recorded conversation that they can discuss, mm-hmm. and it is very sensitive.
Yeah,
and they will be instantly dismissed from their position. And I wouldn't wish that upon anybody. They're just doing this job, this person on the other end of the phone. They're not the decision maker.
Yeah.
This wonderful person, and I won't say male or female, once again, because it'd be a lot easier for them to work it out, but has acknowledged that it is unfair and what they're doing to me is not okay.
And
something needs to change.
Yeah. I want to pose a question to you, and I think what the audience will hear from what you've just said is, firstly, and we've gone through all the emotions in this podcast today, you know, and right now the emotion for you is frustration and anger.
I think, Jay, the anger is beyond. I don't get angry anymore. Yeah. I can't. Like, what am I going to do with that anger? Where am I going to channel it? Yeah. It's not fair to then put that out to the world and somebody else have to carry my – it's not okay. I'm bitter, yeah. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated because we get told in life to do things the right way, take the right channels, be open, be honest, and be heard. We're telling people, speak up about this abuse. I'm telling people, don't hold back from it. But on the other hand, I sound like I'm contradicting things because I'm now sharing my journey, which has been extremely traumatic to the point where, was it even worth me opening up and sharing my journey to seek justice from a perpetrator, a pedophile, a sexual predator who preyed on young boys? And this is, you know, across the board for young women as well that have endured this. Once again, I'm only speaking facts on my behalf. You know, my heart goes out to everybody out there that's a survivor. And this is for everybody. But it's accepted that it's okay for this perpetrator to get away with. He's not judged or she's not judged. Okay, they might lose their job, might get a slap on the wrist at court, maybe might get a little jail sentence, just maybe. It'd have to be pretty bad for them to get any jail sentence. But as a survivor, you're treated like almost like you're the perpetrator. No, I won't even say that because that's not right. You're treated like shit. The perpetrators get treated better than the survivor.
And you feel that you're being treated even worse because of your history, your criminal
100%.
History.
So now I am judged. Now I can clearly and openly speak about my criminal history. My criminal history has always been either violence, drugs or firearms and, you know, theft.
Mm.
So you tell me where that determines what I'm worth in life.
Yeah.
I'm now 46. Yes, there is some things hanging over my head from many, many years ago, and we're not going to go into those here today at all. But it's been since 2009, 2010, since I officially committed a criminal offence. In that time, I started a national charity. In that time, I became the first person in the world to cycle across Australia in 45 days. I rode around Tasmania. I have helped so many thousands of people to not take suicide as an option in their life. that have gone through traumas and heartache and pain, whilst dealing with my own things, I have worn my heart on my sleeve. I have absolutely gone over and above as a human because I believe in seeing people succeed. I want people to be the best they can be. And I've used my own lived experience to help others know that they're not alone and that there are options out there. But the options that are given that I once believed in, I can tell you right now, are a smokescreen. It's disheartening. It's painful. I want to close this door in my life. But yet I'm constantly given what I believe is a programmed response every time I ring up now because it's the same answer. It's still with our counterparts and we're just doing our further investigation. Let me simplify this. Jay, you're going to employ me, okay? Now, thanks, mate. For me to seek employment with your company, I need a criminal history check. Now, that's on a national database now, right, that covers all states and territories. Okay, no longer is it just per state. You can find out very easily what that employee, possible employee, has in their back pocket so you know. I can put a request in, I can purchase that as a public person and have that 7 to 14 days max. It can even be quicker.
Yeah.
How the fuck can a government body take 18 months to tell you they're trying to get your criminal history together to then decide whether you're worthy of any fucking compensation for sexual abuse that you endured at the hands of a government employee? That right there tells me it is bullshit. And that's what I'm going through, is constantly being told, oh, we've just got to go through your criminal antecedent. Oh, we've got to wait for our Queensland counterparts. We've got to wait for New South Wales now. Now it's Queensland's come through, or sorry, New South Wales came through, and now we've got to wait for Queensland now to bring in whatever. What information? What more information? Before anything is done, you have to give them every bit of your life story and detail prior to them even making a decision of allowing it to be pursued and go through. And that's through solicitors.
Yeah.
So everything's done through full legal channels. This is not just me going and on the phone. This is documented stuff that has gone before courts. This is factual evidence. What more do I have to do to wait 18 months to be judged upon and told whether I'm worthy of anything in retribution for what I endured as a young person? And what about the thousands of others out there that are going through the same thing? Or the thousands that are thinking about going that may not do it now because of this situation?
I've got one more question for you, which I think we'll end on. And it's a question I don't know the answer to, and I don't know if you will either, but it's a question that I think the audience will, that those that are listening will understand that maybe something might have been different. Had you have not been abused as a kid in institutions, how different might the life have been?
Really good question, because I walked out the door this morning and I said to my wife, we briefed over this because she knows how sensitive I get when I start talking about this stuff. And my answer to her was, I could have been fucking anything. I was a great rugby league player, extremely intellectual. I had dreams, and it all got taken. I'm not making excuses for my choices later in life at all. I own them. I've put my hand up when I'm guilty, and I've stood strong when I'm fucking not. I've accepted the time that I've been given when I've been put into custody, and I've worked very hard to better myself as a human, to share my lived experience, to hope that others never have to walk down these roads that I've walked. And I'll continue to do that to the day I die, because I love it. I love the reward from it. But I know in my heart, the world was at my feet, mate. I could have been anything.
Simo, thanks, mate.
Thanks, Jay.
Oh, fuck me. Jesus Christ.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, Lab on me going all the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. For the record.